This is November 28th, 1978, 2:00 p.m. The interviewee is Joseph John Marino, and I am Mary Cleghorn. Mr. Marino, we'd like to talk a little bit about your early life and about your ancestry.
Well, my early life was nearly everything that I have learned, especially about living out in the open, and what many things I learned them from my father. Naturally, children learn from seeing what their parents do and how they talk about it. Now, my father raised me more as an Indian, although he was a white man, white skin. In time, years after I had grown up talking, he said that if there was Indian in his family, it would be the Mayo, and the Mayos of Sonora were white. In Spanish, they did not marry anybody with a dark skin. That is, very few of them did. Eventually, they did. He just about had to. But my father left in, I'll go back to my mother's side of the family, which we don't know too much. It's in all in history here in California, books, missions, and what have you. The first man to receive a land grant from the King of Spain was a Capitan Ortega, whether he was a ship captain or an army captain. I'm more inclined to believe that he was an army captain, because ship captains did not leave their ships, rarely. And he was given a land grant. Now, this would have to be long before 1810, when Spain was still, in Mexico. And California still belonged to Spain. Later came the Arianes. They intermarried. They took up land grants from, I think, the Mexican government after 1810. From the Mexican government, they took up land grants. Now, my wife, we have records of the names of their haciendas. One is, I remember, there was a name of Laguna, Hacienda de la Laguna. And at home, of course, when I was born, raised, it was my language was Spanish. Never spoke anything else until I was around 5 years old. And my father came into, I'll go back now. My grandmother was born in Santa Barbara. Records are there. She was baptized in Santa Barbara. And her name was, I have to stop and think. It's a very kind of an odd name. According to my father, according to what he told me many years later, she was part Indian, but her skin was rather dark. And her features, according to my father, she had Indian blood in her.
What kind of Indian?
Chumash. Yes, because she was born and raised in Santa Barbara, and that's the only Indian that were there at that time. And they were a handsome tribe. The Spaniards would naturally intermarry with, the soldiers that came here and all that. But I think that the Arianes intermarried. They married with the Indians there. Because in those days, there was no white woman here. The first white woman, there's also a record of that came into Los Angeles. By that time, Los Angeles was a city. Town. The first 11 white women that came here from Mexico. After that, they started coming in. Anyway, my father came in 1874. I don't know too much about the Arianes and the Ortegas. The only thing I know is that the Ortegas, right now, you go into a store and get some green chilies and can the Ortega chilies. It's just the name is there. That's all that's left. But the Ortegas are the one that started canning them. They're descendants of the old Ortegas. And then there was another one. A cousin of mine started Las Palmas chili. It's still going. And the last time my wife was in Los Angeles, Ventura, his partner was still living, Ferran, a Frenchman. And two of my cousins, two of his sisters. Now, my cousin is dead. He died sometime later and left everything to Farad and his three sisters. I met one of them, Elizabeth Shepherd. She was a widow. Another sort of married me.
Your father was born in Mexico?
My father was born in northeastern Sonora, and in 1874 he crossed from Vasavas, that's an Indian name, over the mountains, Pinal Mountains, and he ended up in Nevada's Tucson. From there, I lost track. I don't remember him telling me how he got to Yuma. He must have joined up with the wagon train and came on through. There in Yuma, he met two young Indians from his hometown, and he got a job there with a man, and one of the jobs was to go and cut a raft of coal on a Gila. He had joined the Colorado there in Yuma. Coming down the river, while he was about to lose his raft, he couldn't bring it in to shore. There were two Indian women washing clothes on the edge of the river, and he called to them and said he'd give them a dollar if they'd go in and swim and push that raft out to the shore. There was an axe, boss's axe on there, and he didn't want to lose it. He didn't care about it. If the raft went on, he wouldn't get paid, of course. But the two women, they just laughed and ripped off their skirts and jumped in the river, and they soon swung that raft around. They got it into a whirlpool when the river turned, and it turned the raft in. My father didn't know that, although he was a good swimmer. He learned to swim in a very swift little river, the Wasatch. Swift and mean when it came up.
Did you know what kind of Indian, did he know what kind of Indian they were?
Oh yeah, they were Shumite, Quichan, Yumas, Yuma Indians. That's all they were. Oh, Cocopas would come sometimes when they were at peace with the Yuma. They were on the Mexican side of the border, down the Colorado River. Now they're all gone. Now the Quichans took a few that are left, took them in, I understand. Cocopas.
Before we go on with your father's life, you told me a story about your father being a mailman. Could you tell us again?
Oh yeah. Before he left, sometime before, there had been trouble in the next state, which is Sinaloa, and the governor there had asked the capital, the Mexican government, for help. The government somehow contacted Sonora and told the governor of Sonora, which was, his name was Pesqueda. I remember that because my father admired that man very much. And he was quite a man, a military man, and brave. And he'd done everything he could for the poor people in Sonora. But at that time, they had Porfirio Diaz as president, and he put up laws that my father didn't like. And he was just waiting to grow up a little older to get out of Mexico. He didn't like the government they had over there. Well, anyway, he was conscripted or put into the... Every young man, when they hit 17, had to join up the... National Guard, the only troops they had there to fight the Apaches. The Apaches were raiding in Mexico almost all the way down to the Yaqui Valley. They wouldn't raid much towards Hermosillo or the east coast of Sonora because the west coast, the Gulf Coast, because of the Papagos and the Pima. They were national enemies of the Apaches, and they're great fighters, the Papagos especially. So they were friendly with all the natives of in Arizona, with the whites and the American people in Arizona, and with the Mexicans in Sonora. The Seri was not. They had run the Seri out of Sonora, the ranchers. That's another little story. But anyway, my father had joined, he was only 16, but they took him in, I guess. And somehow, when this trouble started in Sinaloa, they've got about 200 nationals from different villages, different towns, and my father and an Opaca Indian were in on it. 2 days after, outside of Wausau, was towards they had already reached the city or the county seat, district they call them over there, district of the Moctezuma. They had passed it, and they were camped during the night. Well, a colonel and a major were talking. We're going to pick up some artillery in Guaymas, and we need artillerymen. Well, my father was awake and listening, and he said, well, what do you think? And he pointed towards, they were near the fire, pointed up towards my father. What do you think of that one? My father was very forward, nervy, didn't take anything from nobody. He was jolly, full of life all the time, big-hearted. And in fact, the lunch he had was supposed to last 2 or 3 days, and it was all gone. And within the first 2 days, he's sharing it with a fellow who didn't have anything. In fact, one man told him, what are you going to do now? You need to pour your food. This man used to hide to eat. He says, I'll eat. Well, he'd just go around sounding his little can for pinoa. That was their bread, used water. And somebody, come here, Chiquito, they called him the Chiquito. He was the baby of the family. They called him the Chiquito. Over here, Chiquito, over here. He was all kinds of friends. He never went hungry. But anyway, then my dad listened some more. And again, they continued talking. They were going to have to ship by ship to go to Sinaloa. And my father didn't like that one little bit. He was afraid of the ocean. He'd heard a lot about it. No part of the ocean. So, this is Opata Indian and one Indian. So, we got to whisper them together. What do we do? Get out of here. So, they took off. Went over the hill. My father ended up way in another area, Baviste, someplace. A village where his older brother was, the one that was educated for the priesthood, and he hid out with him and stayed there almost a year. Before they caught it, he came to see my grandfather and my grandmother and his sister. There were no more brothers at home, a nephew, and they picked him up. They arrested him immediately.
Can you remember what year?
Well, if he was 17, that would be 1873. Now, my father, going back, 18 years, 18 from 1872, he was 18 to go back, you get his age. He was born in the 50s sometime. 50s. Well, he was the baby of 10. 8 brothers and 2 sisters. Now, 2 sisters already left, and 1, 2, 3, 4 brothers, 5, 6 brothers already left the country. He was the only one left there of the brothers, and 1 sister stayed behind. Yeah, 1 sister had left for California. 2 brothers married 2 of my father's sisters. 1 stayed behind, pregnant. The other one went with her husband, California. When my father got to California, they were very poor. He was an alcoholic, the brother-in-law. And my father worked for years to take care of the family. That's another little story.
Let's go back to where he went back to see his father.
Oh, yes. Anyway, they picked him up, and
Rurales, or
huh?
Is that the way you pronounce it, Rurales?
No, this is Nacionales. This is like the National Guard here. You know, they're in the service, but they're home all the time. Whenever they're needed, they're just called out immediately. They just grab their guns, some lunch, whatever they can do, and get going. And my father done that 2 or 3 times, even before he had been picked up. And then later, after he had been picked up, after he'd been with him. Anyway, So, of course, my grandfather called the other son. This was not notified, the other son where my brother had, my father had been living since he went over the hill. Well, this uncle of mine proved that they had picked him up when he was only 16, and that saved him from being put for a long shot. But even the National Guard wouldn't do; they would be shot. And anyway, the colonel said, "Well, the man in charge of the case said we just can't let him go free. We're going to have to give him some kind of punishment." So that was the punishment. They all got together, the officers, you know, and said, well, they needed mail carriers. Nobody really wanted to go because of the Apache. They were killing them. They used to start two men on horseback over the mountains. Apaches would kill them. Then they started one man on horseback. They would kill him. Too much noise. Then two men. Still too much noise. They'd kill him. So they started off with one each direction, wherever they went. And that's the only way they carried their mail.
What was your father's mail route?
From Wasawas to Oposura. And that would be the 36 miles over the mountains to the district headquarters. Would be the district. Would be the same as county seat here.
The Sierra Madre?
That's Moctezuma, district of Moctezuma. He went 36 miles. He would leave at 8:30 when the town was quiet. He would leave, and by 3 o'clock he'd be knocking on the mayor's door to turn the mail in. He'd stay and spend the day, sleep, and that night he'd leave and come back.
Carrying mail? Carrying mail back?
Mm-hmm. But there'd be more going out than coming in. The little town, not many people riding. The other way they sent mail first to California was somebody who was coming this way, they'd hand him a letter. He'd meet somebody that was heading this way, they'd hand him the letter. Sometimes it took a year for a letter to get from that little town to California. Well, after 6 months, he was chased by Apaches once. Coming into the town where he was going to deliver the mail, he happened to look. People living in that kind of a life and that kind of times, they had instinct, a certain instinct when danger was around, and certain little things would tell them, changes in their something. Maybe nightbirds or something in their change there would tell you there was danger somewhere. And I learned certain animals, certain birds can tell you what's going on. You can learn a lot from the animals, including little mice. From the mice. You can tell what's around you. Well, he happened to look back over. It was a long mesa, sloping mesa, about 3 miles. He happened to look over, and about 200 feet behind him, he saw three come up, running. And he saw their hair set against the starlight. So he started off with about 60 pounds on his back. Started off, and he was fast. And when he got in the next morning, he told the men, well, he'd give them notice right away, and they woke up some of the men at 3 o'clock in the morning. He came out with their guns. They didn't believe him. Well, but when daylight came, he showed them the tracks. Three Apaches had followed him. Well, they come right up close where the dogs begin to bark. They turned around and went back. Fast. They always were attacking in that part of the country, just little groups. He said most of them are over, and never no large groups of Apaches would travel together because they had to live off the land, either water or food. And so not too many traveled. They raided all the way beyond Wasawas, which is would be about 140, 150. I don't know just how far it was, but I traveled a distance one way, then came back, and both about the same distance. About 150 miles south of Douglas.
I won't be at the Blackwater. Well, after, when my father was 18, sometime after that, they were attacked, ambushed by Apaches, 11 Apaches. And there was six men and a woman. The man and his wife were traveling with this group. The man in charge who had all the horses and what have you. They were packing flour, sugar, and salt, and fuses that a powder man had made for the miners. And they were caught in a very narrow canyon, steep hill, mountain, both sides. Now, like my father says, used to tell me, you could, I asked him, now, when he was telling me this little story, why is it you got caught? Too late, we sense it. He says, Apaches can hide in nowhere, on flat ground. They're there, you can't see them. And they can lay there for hours, not move a finger, or eyelash. You can walk right past, he told me, an Apache 10 feet away from him. If he doesn't want you to see him, you don't see him. He may have one little bush to hide on. I asked him, how is it? How could they? You had sharp eyes? Yes. Too late? I saw them. And the noises we couldn't hear because the horses' feet and the rocks and whatever. This was a little canyon. Well, they opened fire. Now they had repeating rifles, Henrys. Fired it up to, 16 shells and cartridges. You know? They weren't muzzle loaded. Now, in their group, there was one Opata Indian had one muzzle loader with a cap and ball rifle. It was a Kentucky. It had been made over from the flintlock to the cap and ball. And he had a wrist here where he carried all these caps. He had over 300 loads for his rifle. Now, the cartridges were made paper cartridges with a bullet in it, the powder and the bullet. And all a man had to do was bite the end of the paper and just drop it in the rifle and hit the rifle on the ground, and the bullet went all the way down. Put the cap on, you could fire pretty quick. Well, they had that one big old blunderbuss that had been made to a cap, and then they had three bullets for it. A pistol, a revolver that was cap and ball. It was a little about a .32, I guess, a small gun. It had only three shells. These were poor people trying to make a little money, I guess, traveling. Very foolishly, I thought. My dad was telling me the story. He thought it was foolish afterwards, but he had a lot of nerve. He was paid 25 centavos a day to travel with him. He was the one that guarded the mules or the horses during the night when they were out. They had to pasture them and miss it wherever they could and then tie them up close into camp when they camped at night because of the danger of Apaches. Well, anyway, when they opened fire, my father looked back and he saw the man and his wife, saw the man go over. And my father had promised that woman, he was quite a ladies' man, I guess, and he had promised that woman that she was afraid. She'd been scared. My father had taken his shirt off and given it to her, and she had put it over her hat to keep the sun off. Well, he'd promised that he would take her out of any trouble if she came to. So he raced back, and the woman was running towards the front where the men had already run for the side of the mountain, away from the Apaches. They were on one side of the mountain, away from the Apaches, and up to the side of the other mountain, started to build a fort or pile up rocks to hide behind. And the Apaches were firing all the time. My father got a hold of the woman's arm and was running just as he was about ready to turn in toward up the mountain to where his boss and the other men were.
wise. He sent something to his right and he
stepped back, stopped, and the Apache fired.
He missed him and hit the woman from back, the bullet went from side to side. And she fell. My father started to pick her up, and his boss called him, "Chiquito, let her go. She's of another world." And he started running towards where the men were still piling up rocks. All he had was a rock in each hand. Then he had stooped and picked up two rocks. And he started running. He counted 13 shots in 11 steps. He decided he was going to count shots to see how many it took to get him. But he made it to the rock pile where they had piled up these rocks. Another natural rocks, or a natural fort. And they just beat it a little better. So there was this Opata Indian with his good rifle watching, looking to see what he could shoot. About that time, when the time he got to the rock pile, he saw an Apache running up towards the mountain, zigzagging. And the other jumping around, says they looked like crows. Just all you'd see was their head, maybe. Their hair. They all wore a band around their head. And their hair was not too long. And they wore shirts, something like the what some did. And a sapeta, or a g-string. Moccasins up to the knee, or Apache boots. And he was stooping over, and the boss says, "Chiquito, look towards the left." Oh, there was an Indian firing from behind a ocote. That's a kind of a tree. I think it's called here, it's called elephant trees. Very thick and ugly looking. This Apache was firing from there, and he's firing very rapidly, shot after shot, was hitting the rock. And one man, who was the one with the blunderbuss, he saw he was firing from about 100 feet away across the canyon, so he aimed and fired. Well, he hit that, of course, and it was pretty thick. So the Apache bounced out of there and started running up the mountain. Because with all the firing, they were afraid there might be some more people coming along their way. So anyway, my father's boss says, "Chiquito, look to the west." And he was just bent over behind the rocks with his hands on his knees, on his thighs rather, and as he turned, he was knocked down. The man with the pistol was pointing in between some rocks, and a bullet hit that pistol, and then it hit my father in the stomach-like. It knocked him down. He felt pain. He went under his undershirt right away. That woman had his shirt. He went under and felt to see if it had any blood. There was no blood. He was wearing a scapulary with a metal edge and some safety thing, some religious thing he was wearing. And the bullet had hit the pistol, flattened out, went through his shirt, hit the scapulary, and went through the other side. But it knocked him down. It was a heavy bullet. Well, after a while, the Opata Indian, they were brave men, fighters, natural enemies of the Apaches. He saw where he had a good shot, and he was a good shot with that Kentucky rifle. And he started to aim, and the boss was scared. "Don't kill him because they'll finish us," he said. My father got mad. And Opata lost his nerve, and he became shaky, and he just grabbed on that rifle. My father tried to grab the rifle, and the Indian would not leave it, would not let go. The Opata was a young boy. He was frightened, froze. Well, anyway, after a while, the Apache disappeared. Well, they drove the horses away. They had run out, and they drove them away.
Maybe that's all they wanted.
Yeah, the one that's all they wanted, and to kill as many as they could. And they hated those people down below because, well, they had a good reason. At one time, long before that, my grandfather, and long before my father was born, he used to deal with the Apaches over in Arizona and Chihuahua, with the Apache Indians. He was in good with them, and he used to trade with them. He used to take, he'd trade for hides, mostly for hides, and once in a while a good horse, or a mule. The Apache loved mule. They loved to eat mule. The neck was their favorite. Anyway, my father had to, the boss told him, somebody has to go for help. Well, somebody gave me a gun.